Hey guys, thanks for listening. If you'd like to support us, go to patreon.com/frightday.
Ooh, that one really got me. I didn't like that that came back.
Yeah.
Good.
When a guy tries to bury that.
It is
Fright Day. This is episode 67. I'm your host, Byron. And tonight, we're talking a lonely girl's violent descent into madness, reviewing the latest film from Mickey Keating, Darling. But before we get there, you'll hear a conversation I had with Darling herself, Lauren Ashley Carter. And we head to Point Pleasant, West Virginia, home of a troublemaking, potentially supernatural manifestation with quite the death toll. We're talking the Mothman. In this week's edition of Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracies, I'm joined tonight by Kelly.
Hello!
And Sam.
Hey, guys.
Kelly, we just got done doing something.
What?
A once-a-month special recording that you're in charge of.
What's it called, Byron?
Do I have to?
You do. You brought it up.
It's called Captain Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracies. So that was exciting. We got that in the bag.
It was great. It was
a lot
really
of podcasting
fun.
Podcasting for one day.
It is, but it's all good podcasting.
It's definitely content.
And people who want that content, all they have to do is go to patreon.com/frightday and donate, contribute, just give us cash.
Give us your money, all of it.
It should be up April 1st.
And that's no joke.
Not a joke at all.
Not a joke.
Just a coincidence. But since this show is so jam-packed, what do you say we jump right into what we watch this week?
Let's just jump in.
Kelly, what you watch?
Well, we had a funny experience last night. Sam and I sat down and attempted to watch a movie on Shudder because I made a list of all the movies on Shudder that I really want to see that I haven't seen.
This is different from the list of top 13 films you need to watch on Shudder.
Yeah. So these
available at Friday.com.
Yeah. Alex and I actually put our heads together and came up with a pretty cool list of the top 13 movies that are on Shudder right now.
Check it out.
But when I was perusing and trying to kind of curate that list, I came across some films that I hadn't seen that I was pretty interested in seeing. So I put together my own personal little to-do list from Shudder. Sam and I laid down last night and started watching one.
Hold your horses. Shudder is like Netflix, but exclusively for horror.
Just horror.
I'm sure we've talked about it a million times, but if this is your first time, Shudder.com.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Really, really cool. And they actually have very cool curated categories themselves, and they get directors to come and curate lists. It's very, very fun.
Currently, Alexander Aja.
They've got a list that he did for them, which is really fun. Sam and I sit down to watch this last night, and it's a movie that one of our listeners, Hugster, recommended many moons ago, and we finally have access to it through Shudder, called Citadel.
I've heard a lot of good things about Citadel.
Yeah, so we started watching it. It was unbelievable. It involved a baby, so I was obviously a train wreck from the get-go.
Yeah.
It was very sad, but very good. So far, what were we, Sam? 25 minutes into it, maybe? It just stopped working. Like, it just kept stopping and stopping. I think it's our internet. You know how we have issues with our internet?
Yeah, I can't blame Shudder for that.
No, I don't think it was Shudder, but it literally stopped, and we tried to press play again, and it would, like, play for 30 seconds, then it stopped. We did that for 15 minutes trying to fix it. Finally, we had to give up. So then we moved to Exorcismus.
Exorcismus?
Yes.
You know, I've heard the name. I know nothing about this film.
You know how we feel about movies that have exorcism in the title. You can't have enough of them.
It actually turns out that the movie was just fine. It wasn't great, but it was fine. We got about 3/4 of the way through it.
Don't say it.
Yes. Happened again.
Oh, you
have 3/4 of the way through the movie. So it was a rather exasperating film watching experience last night. But technically, we tried to watch two different movies.
First of all, this is what you get for living in the middle of the woods.
We don't live in the middle of the woods.
You basically do.
Oh, the Barrens. We call them the Barrens around these parts.
What'd you think about the parts of Exorcismus that you did watch?
Well, I would say it combined some POV action with an exorcism. So I would have to say on our scale of 1 to 10 that it was a piece of shit.
Okay. Not interested in the film, are you?
No. Couldn't fucking care less.
Sam's being a little bit brutal to it, which is no surprise. I thought it was actually pretty interesting. There were a couple of things that they did that were really creepy. As the end begins to reveal itself, suddenly I realized that at some point in time, channel surfing or something when we once had cable, I must have seen the last 15 minutes of this movie.
So basically, we were nightmare people when we were watching this.
Yeah.
That's understandable. I mean,
so we get to a point in the movie and I'm like, wait a second. I know how this ends. And then that's kind of when it stops playing and stops working. So luckily, I know what happens with the rest of the movie because I'd seen it already, just not known that I'd seen it.
Would you recommend anyone else attempt to watch
this
movie?
Yeah, actually, I think it's fun for anybody who likes the exorcism subgenre. Certainly lots of teen angst going on, but I thought the teenagers were pretty good actors. The parents weren't quite as good as the teenagers were in it, but there's some fun occult stuff that I think B would be interested in, possibly.
Sure.
It's perfect for the situation in which we watched it. It's a great hanging at home, check out your streaming options, good horror movie.
Yeah, and I'm looking at Shudder right now. The Alexander Aja curated list is actually really great.
It's of course it is.
Antichrist, Audition, Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, and Room 237.
There you go.
All home run films.
Yep.
And the categories are fantastic. I don't know if we've mentioned this before.
I think we have.
Have we?
But it's done so well.
Love Sick, Midnight at Sundance, which is a whole collection of Sundance features. Terror Transgressive, which is taboo, boundary pushing, underground horror.
AKA Necromantic.
I still haven't seen Necromantic.
We need to watch that.
We need to make Kelly watch that.
That's what we need to do.
Not happening.
So Kelly, you kind of struck out on Shudder, but we have a list of 13 films that are guaranteed to be home runs at Frightday.com.
And my guess is wherever you are that isn't where we are, your internet's going to work great and you're going to be able to watch all of them. Lucky you.
Exciting. Well, I streamed something this week as well.
What?
But it was on Netflix.
Oh, that's okay. What was it? What was it? What was it?
Calm down, please. It is a Blumhouse Netflix dump called Curve.
Tell me.
You remember I mentioned starting this several weeks ago, maybe even a month ago.
A while back.
So this girl is driving her fiance's truck to Denver to meet him and to get hitched. While driving in the lonely road, she talks to her sister on the phone and decides to take a detour to the Grand Canyon. She's having that last hurrah by herself. Out of the blue, her truck stops and she can't get into service with her cell phone. However, a gentle drifter named Christian offers to fix her car and she accepts.
Uh-oh.
He's like one of those guys that can take his shirt off and girls are impressed, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You ever see those guys?
Don't trust them.
I fucking hate those guys.
She offers him a ride because he's so nice. And while she's driving, he says some pretty dirty things to her.
Like maybe his Tourette's or something?
No, he just kind of flipped a switch and is like, why don't you?
Uh-oh.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was a bit offensive. And she asks him to leave, but he pulls out a knife and says, we're going to go to this abandoned motel.
Oh, that's not what you want to hear.
It's a scary situation she's put in. But she gets this clever idea to swerve off of the road and unbuckle his seatbelt while she crashes her car. Which isn't a great idea. Let's be real.
I don't know. I kind of feel like that's about as good an idea as I could come up with.
Well, you'd be wrong. What happened is she ended up pinning her leg between the door and her dashboard, rendering her useless, basically.
She should have crashed better.
Probably. So she's stuck upside down in a car, and this guy decides to leave her there. Comes back and checks on her, tortures her a little bit. Not really physically at this point, but yeah, it's kind of interesting. It's more than I expected, but it ended up not being anything I asked for, really.
Really?
Yeah. It's directed by Ian Softley, who directed Hackers and K-Pax, as well as The Skeleton Key.
I love K-Pax. I love The Skeleton Key. That's a classic.
No, it's not.
It is Kate Hudson.
Sure. Just none of these movies.
Southern Gothic horror?
Are interesting to me.
I'm with Byron on this one.
But that doesn't mean that it's a bad looking
K-Pax
movie.
K-Pax is one of the most boring alien movies of all time.
I didn't really get it. I was too young to understand what
it was
about.
You should rewatch it. It's actually a fabulous movie.
And sorry, Byron.
That's okay. And the lead star is Julianne Hough, who you may know as one of the coaches on Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah, she's
you may not.
I thought she did a fine job. It's just she was in a situation that had provided very little forward movement, and the resolution was definitely not worth it to me. Our antagonist, though, the man I mentioned, the creepy dude, Teddy Sears, who people may know from The Flash or Masters of Sex or that short-lived TV show 666 Park Avenue.
Oh.
No one watched it. It's okay. Don't feel bad. He did an amazing job flipping from this nice guy to total psychopath. I thought it was cool, but he did it pretty often. It kind of removes the shock of it. Bottom line, I think you can do a lot worse on Netflix, but there's a lot of good stuff out there.
So it sounds like you'd maybe not recommend.
I said you could do a lot worse.
So maybe, okay.
That's all. Just try harder, guys. There's plenty of good stuff hiding beyond the new releases section of Netflix.
And Amazon Prime, too.
Absolutely. Or even Shudder.
Shudder me timbers.
But I think that's all I watched this week, honestly.
There's that movie that we both watched, Byron.
Oh my gosh, how could I forget?
I don't know.
So we got an advanced copy of the new Mike Flanagan film, who you may know as the director of Oculus. It's called Hush. It debuted at South by Southwest. People were freaking out about it.
Not to be confused with the Gwyneth Paltrow, Jessica Lange film.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
How do you feel about it?
I really, really liked Hush. What did you think, Byron?
Yeah, I don't know how much we can talk about it. I think it was great. It definitely had that Mike Flanagan feel. Spooky stuff.
A deaf woman is stalked by a psychotic killer in her secluded home.
Ooh.
Yeah. And John Gallagher Jr. stars as Man, as he's credited, which can probably tell you that he's not someone we like.
And he was Emmett in 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Yes.
Yes. Different role here. Kate Siegel also co-wrote this movie and starred in it as Maddie. Really a well-executed, especially considering the budget, home invasion slasher.
They did a lot with a little. They took a simple premise, added some really unique twists, and then made a really beautiful movie.
Very much so. And all the production values were great. The sound was great. The lighting was great. It looked really fantastic. I mean, we talked a little bit about this earlier, but I think this could have made a reasonable box office impact. As far as the Blumhouse, you know, mid to low budget releases go, I think this would have definitely turned a profit.
And it's coming out directly onto Netflix, which is an interesting decision.
I think that it's kind of a cool format to explore. I know that there are a lot of different ways that distributors and even filmmakers themselves are trying to get their movies released to get them in front of more audiences. It'll be interesting to see how this one pans out. Obviously, I haven't seen it, so I can't say whether it seems like a film that's well suited for that approach, but you guys could speak to that better than I could.
I think we talked a little bit about this with Patrick Bryce, the idea of this as a viable option for directors to get their films out and get paid, you know, as opposed to wasting money promoting on something like VOD or even theatrical where no one's going to be showing up. This is a place where a movie like Hush can get an audience. People can take a risk on a movie on Netflix, even though, I mean, Mike Flanagan's made a name for himself, obviously. Oculus was very well received.
Yes.
I love this movie. I thought it was great.
And it was very tight. There wasn't a lot of fat.
Sounds like you guys like this better than Oculus.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. Very cool.
For sure.
But I mean, you know, I don't necessarily like Supernatural as much as you do.
True.
I think this is a great direction for Mike.
I probably won't like it as much as what this is sounding like.
Probably not.
I'm a sucker also for creepy masks.
Creepy masks.
I do love John Gallagher Jr. He's one of my faves.
Well, then I think you'll like this movie.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
So that's April 8th. It'll be out on Netflix for everyone to watch. You're going to be talking about it with your friends. You're going to love it. But you know what, guys?
What?
I talked to someone last week.
Who?
The lovely Lauren Ashley Carter, who you may know from films like Jug Face or The Woman.
Yeah.
Or Pod.
Pod most recently, so good. Which made all three of our lists of top 13 horror films of last year.
Yeah.
So what do you say we play that interview right now in preparation for our review of Darling?
I cannot wait to hear what she had to say. Lauren Ashley Carter, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So I was lucky enough to catch your new film, Darling, but for those who haven't been able to, could you tell us a little bit about the movie and your character?
Sure. So Darling is a black and white horror film that's set in New York City. Mickey likes to do, except for Carnage Park, I think was a very obvious period piece. Usually he just kind of does an essence of a period piece, I would say. He doesn't really stick to it. But we definitely have some Polanski vibes going on, very Repulsion-esque, as you probably noticed. Mm-hmm. So it's a young woman who is a caretaker of homes. So she's, a house sitter is what you could say. And she's kind of peculiar, and she ends up in this giant eight-bedroom home in New York City, in Harlem, actually. And takes care of this home, and while she's there, weird things start to happen, and she begins to behave strangely as well. and she kind of unravels throughout the movie.
Spectacularly.
Yeah, glorious unraveling.
Your character, Darling, is extremely intense and rather complex as well. Where did you draw your inspiration for her?
Well, before, whenever Mickey does films, he usually gives you about 3,000 movies to watch before you begin. So we watched a ton of movies, both he and I. A Cold Day in the Park was a big one. Repulsion was definitely one of the first ones. And that's more of a, to get a vibe from anything. The quietude of it, I think, was a huge part. And the stillness and being able to take my time, which sometimes you're not really allowed to do that because it can, you know, on screen, sometimes when actors are like really giving you their face and they're just working their emotion, you're like, I get it. You're a great actor. Let's move on. I'm tired of this right now. But in this movie, I think that it definitely warranted those moments and the thinking moments to watch Darling think. So it was really more that, you know, we talked with each other, Mickey and I, and we created this character together. It started out as an apartment movie, and then my friend actually owns that house.
No
and
way.
She an older woman that I actually was dog sitting for years ago, and in her apartment, and then she had so many problems with the apartment that she sold it and then bought this home in Harlem and completely redid it. And she was in the process of redoing it, and I was visiting her, telling her Mickey and I were making this movie together and looking for a location. And she goes, well, why don't you just shoot it here? And I called him right away while I was sitting there on her, on the balcony, which you probably remember.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sitting there and I called Mickey and I said, so how do you feel about doing a little bit of a rewrite so that we can do this in this giant house? And he was so excited about it. So I took a ton of pictures and he was really, really pumped. And yeah, I think that Darling just started happening organically as we talked. And the biggest thing for me was that I actually stayed in the house during filming.
What?
Yeah, I was living there. So I was living there and working 12-hour days as Darling. It was pretty easy to fall into a madness, I would say.
Are you the kind of person that believes in any supernatural existence, paranormal activity, ghosts, stuff like that?
I do. I've never experienced it, unfortunately. I wish that I did. My sister has definitely had a lot of strange experiences. I've had, and my mother have had, a lot of clairvoyant dreams.
Oh, wow.
I call them, mine are useless. Hers are really freaky and strange and things can happen. Mine are always useless dreams. There were a couple really weird ones, but yeah, I've had some odd moments. I've always wanted more. I have many stories from friends. I have friends that even go into places with the recorders and record voices and noises, and I listen to those, and I'm really into it. I wish more ghosts would find me.
So you mentioned that Mickey gave you several films to watch for reference before starting Darling, and before the release of Pod, we actually reached out to Mickey for 13 films that influenced that film. He seems to be quite the film buff.
Right.
And I guess I'm wondering, what's it like working with Mickey Keating?
Yeah, he's a big movie buff, and he'll give you this big list, and he'll tell you specific moments to watch, and you know, because he's thinking very specifically when he does his films, and so there's an essence of that. You know, I never want to copy all the moments because then my acting will look quite Sybil-like, I would think,
mm-hmm.
or a little strange. But it's good to get a feeling. Usually, you know, you can see what he's going for. But as a director working with him, he knows exactly what he wants for every take, for every shot. He knows the feeling that he wants. So, you know, he'll let you play, and he loves to let actors do their own blocking and see how it works out and then make little adjustments. But he's very easygoing.
How did you two come together? Was Pod the first thing you worked on?
Yes, Pod was the first. I actually met him through Lauren Conesani, who is a producer with Ilium Pictures. And Ilium Pictures co-produced Pod. I actually met Ilium Pictures through Pod, and now they're my sister company.
Oh, wow.
And I work with them all the time, and we just finished our first feature together called Imitation Girl, which is a sci-fi drama, and that'll be out next year. It's by director Natasha Kermani. So Lauren and Natasha are great friends, and Lauren Mickey was looking for people. Lauren did some special effects for Pod, like the cuts and things like that on Brian Morvan. He said he was looking for some East Coast people. She said, well, Brian would be great. And Lauren Ashley Carter does a lot of horror movies. And he had seen Jugface, so he was really excited about me playing Lila. And we had a Skype conversation, talked about film for a while, and then part happened and got to meet up with all of them. And it just kind of, yeah, magically happened. And then Mickey and I kept in touch for a long time after Pod. And I was constantly, you know, asking him what was going on. And I said, you know, Mickey, I got to play a villain. I'll never get to play a villain until I get older. I really want to play a villain now. So I just kept pushing the issue. And he was kind of in between getting funding for Carnage Park, I think. And so Darling just happened. It happened very quickly and everything kind of fell into place for it.
And you're also in Joe Bigas's upcoming film, The Mind's Eye?
Yes, right? I'm so excited. I get to see it for the first time at the Chattanooga Film Festival at the end of this month.
I've heard great things about that film festival. I was talking to Jeremy Gardner a couple weeks ago, and that's where his latest film premiered.
Yes, and we have a publicist that was a publicist for Darling, and also now our film Imitation Girl with Alien Pictures, Kayla, and she also says amazing things about it. So I'm really excited about going. And I was in Tennessee, not too far in Nashville, to shoot Jugface. I absolutely loved it. Had a great time there, even though I was filming most of the time, but it was just beautiful. And the people were awesome. And the food is great. There's nothing that you can hate about it.
I might have to make the trip down.
Yeah.
Can you share a little bit about The Mind's Eye? I mean, I know everything has been kind of hush-hush about it, but the buzz has been killing me.
Yeah, well, like I said, I have not seen it, but I can talk about making it.
Sure.
And I definitely heard the buzz. Everyone, all the reviews I've read, people say, like screaming. And there's a really fabulous part I know from making it where there's a sex scene happening with Graham Skipper and myself. Mm-hmm. We're boyfriend-girlfriend in the film. And this is intercut with a scene with the crazy doctor. And the cutting between these two is supposed to be very phenomenal and hilarious and really really twisted. So I'm excited about that. Joe is fabulous. He's crazy, man. He shoots everything, you know?
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So he's the DP on all of this. And he's out there with his camera. So I'm in like pussy deep snow, right? And we're like, the guys, it's up to their knees, but I'm 5'1". Uh-huh. So it's like right up in my vagina. And we didn't have any coats or anything on because we just escaped, you know? So we're just escaping the house and running out there. And it's just up in my crotch. I can hardly move my legs. And normally this kind of thing would be, you know, you get irritated because the director's back at Video Village watching this on a screen and like, again, do it again, but we don't do it in the snow you've already run through. Do it in the fresh snow and just keep going. But it was so awesome because Joe is right there with you, but also with this giant camera on his shoulders and just like running as fast as we are up the hill behind us. And like all the other guys, the crew members are running behind him, you know, trying to pull focus as best they can. And it's action filled every day working with Joe Bigas.
And equally uncomfortable for him, which is how it should be.
Exactly. See, I really enjoy that. Then, you know, I don't complain as much.
Yeah. So Lauren, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
What is it about Jackie Chan? Why did you start recording yourself reading Jackie Chan's 1998 autobiography, I Am Jackie Chan, My Life in Action?
Yes. The Jackie Chan story. Well, so this guy I'm dating is Taiwanese.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this autobiography, right? And he's seen every single Jackie Chan movie ever. So I would ask him questions because I love martial arts. I'm not as, he's huge, huge fan. He's seen everything, but I'm a pretty big fan. And I love Jackie Chan. I love Stephen Chow. I love comedy. I like martial arts comedies.
Sure.
That's kind of my favorite. But I also love, you know, some Jean-Claude Van Damme any day. But so I started asking him some questions and he was, oh, I don't know. And I said, did you read this book? And he's like, no, I got it because I wanted to, but I don't. So he has a really hard time reading books. And I decided that, I said, well, what if I did an audiobook and did, you know, sent you chapters and when you were on the road? And he was like, oh, that'd be so hilarious. Well, it was kind of a joke and I never did it. And finally, he kept bugging me about it. Are you going to do it? Hey, it'd be really nice to hear some Jackie Chan right now while I'm driving. so finally I was doing it, and it was Friday night, and I realized I'm sitting in my apartment with a bottle of wine reading from Jackie Chan, and this is just ridiculous on a Friday night. So I tweeted about it, and Lucky McKee, the director of The Woman, mm-hmm. saw this tweet and said, I have to hear this. Put it online right now. So I recorded it and put out the first one. And then he and a bunch of my other friends from Ilium and all these other people, like fans, and then just random people from SoundCloud all started liking it. And I did the one chapter, and then there were about 15 or so people that all said, oh, can you please do another one? So I said, okay, and I did another one, and then it kept getting retweeted, and it kind of became a thing. And I went to Philadelphia, I was doing a show, and I stopped for a while, and then I had all these people, one of my best friends, Natasha, she said, are you going to do any more chapters? Because I listen to it every morning when I make my breakfast, and they're the perfect length. So the thing about the chapters is that most of them are 3 pages on average.
Sure.
Some of them are half a page. So you'll get some that are like a minute long and then others that are 12, 15 minutes long. And it's also written in the Chinese translations are transliterations. And it's not the pinyin, which I do know. It's Jackie Chan's pinyin because this was back in the 90s. So I'm just guessing at all of this. And I don't read ahead and I do it cold and I really fuck up sometimes. And sometimes people are around me. Sometimes there's construction going on. I'm thinking about actually bringing it into a jazz club and just reading it live, going up on a live mic night. And
oh my God.
So it's turned into kind of my life's work, I guess.
Sure.
I'm only halfway through and I'm on the 42nd chapter.
Well, it's extremely compelling for us. And that's incredibly sweet of you to do that for your boyfriend.
Yeah. I'm nice sometimes.
So what's next for you? Are you working on anything you can talk about right now?
So we're finishing Imitation Girl. This is a big feat. I play 2 characters, an alien version of a real woman who is a failed concert pianist turned amateur porn star. That's going to be fantastic, and that'll be out next year. And then I'm talking with Mr. Vegas right now about another film. I'm sure he has not announced anything about it, so this is still in the making.
Very hush.
Yes, of course. I don't want to piss him off, that's for damn sure. And then I have a couple other films that are in pre-production right now. Nothing that's concrete yet, but I'm also writing a movie musical about schizophrenia.
Oh, wow.
So with the music by Laura Stevenson, who is an amazing singer and songwriter.
So between all these projects, are you going to find any time to start your YouTube series Tea Time back up?
Oh, my Tea Times. Yeah. So my buddy who does Tea Time, actually, he's been traveling around the country. So he's in New Orleans right now, and he'll be returning to New York at some point, and then we might get the Tea Times going back up again. They were a really fun project for us. We're big David Lynch fans, and we wanted to do something very Lynchian and weird and show off my weird side, I guess, and just have fun. And we did. We had so much fun making those.
Well, I know I enjoyed it. I was lucky enough to get one of my questions in 1 week.
Oh, that's great. That's right. That's how I remember.
Yeah. Well, Darling is right around the corner. It's going to be in theaters April 1st. Is that right?
That's right. April 1st in select theaters, which I don't know. And people keep asking, and I find out probably after you guys find out. But then April 6th, I believe it'll be on video on demand. So if it's not playing in a theater near you, see it on video on demand. It's great to see in the theater because the sound is just, well, you know, it's
incredible,
crazy,
absolutely
ripping through. So that's good for a theater, but also if you have awesome speakers at home, then it's great on video on demand too.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Lauren, for doing this. Hopefully we can talk again soon.
Yeah, I would love that. Absolutely. Whenever you like.
What a treat.
Lucky you, B. McGee.
That's just a little sample of what we're going to be talking about later in the show. But for now, Kelly, who's this man you're talking about?
Moth Man?
I guess. I don't know.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
In this week's edition of Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracies?
You bet you bet.
Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracies.
Well, guys, I just tried to do a really great Mothman noise, and they wouldn't let me do it. So I'm going to have to do a lead-in that isn't quite as thrilling as the one that I wanted. We're going to just get straight into the story then, okay, everyone?
Sure.
It's 1966 in West Virginia. It's middle of November. Pretty chilly. And it was colder in the 60s. It was before global warming, you know?
Well, that's debatable.
So it's November 12th. We're near Clendenin, West Virginia. Five guys are at the local cemetery, and they're actually getting a grave ready for burial. They are not grave robbers.
Or just people hanging out on lunch.
Yeah, no, it's, some people like to tell the story like it was grave robbers. It's nothing that scandalous. So these fellas are out there preparing a grave for burial. Suddenly, they see something rise up from some nearby trees and fly over their head. And they describe it as looking like a brown human being.
Uh-oh. Clearly, what year was this?
It was 66.
All right.
Yep. That sounds about right.
Clearly had the ability to fly. Didn't appear to be a bird, but more like a man with wings. And this was the very first appearance of what became famously known as the Mothman.
You don't need to make that noise.
No, but I want to.
Okay, you can do it. Okay.
A couple days later, two married couples had a really strange encounter with a being that was described fairly similar to the one that these five gravediggers discussed.
More or less racist.
Well, I think...
It was a brown man.
Yeah, I don't feel like those would have been the words they used if they were being racist, so...
Well, that took a dark turn.
I'm just saying it's West Virginia in the 60s. I'm guessing that there was some racism.
Okay. Yeah, I know. It was the joke. Now it's not even funny.
Look okay. At you killing humor.
Yay me. There happens to be this very creepy abandoned TNT plant near Point Pleasant, West Virginia. It shut down near the end of World War II. So there's a lot of creepiness in this area, even if it weren't for alleged Mothman. But on November 15th, two married couples are in this area. As they're driving past it, they spot two large eyes attached to something that was shaped like a man, but bigger, maybe 7 feet tall. And it had wings folded against its back. The creature moves towards the plant door. They're watching this as they're driving by. The couples freak out and speed away in their car. But only a few moments later, they see the same creature on a hillside near the road, and they watch as it spreads its wings and rises into the air, follows the car, which at this point is now traveling about 100 miles per hour.
Oh, no.
Whoa.
You know what they should have done? Just flick off those lights.
And the bird kept up with them.
The bird? Or is it a moth?
Well, they're calling it a man? It's a bird moth man.
Details are flimsy.
It's just flying science.
So they tell the deputy sheriff, Millard Halstead, that it followed them all the way down Highway 62 right to Point Pleasant city limits. It turns out they weren't the only people that saw the same creepy looking creature that evening. Another group of four witnesses say they saw it three different times that same evening. About 10:30 that evening, a gentleman named Newell Partridge, a building contractor. He lives about 90 miles south of Point Pleasant at this point. He's watching TV and suddenly the screen went dark and there was a weird pattern that filled the screen, almost like a really small houndstooth.
Herringbone?
It was a really small... Do you want to go with herringbone?
Sure.
It's a really small herringbone pattern.
You don't need to change it for me.
On the screen that comes up as he's watching it. He hears a loud whining sound from outside that starts raising pitches and then it stops. He said it sounded like a generator winding up.
Could it have been a generator?
No. Listen to this. So he had a dog named Bandit who started howling on the front porch. And Newell went out to see what was going on with the dog. When he walked outside, he saw that the dog was facing the hay barn, which was about 150 yards from the house. He turned on a flashlight in that direction and spotted two red circles that looked like eyes or even bicycle reflectors. He said they were certainly not animals' eyes, and the sight of them frightened him. Bandit, his dog, was a very experienced hunting dog and obviously very protective as such. So he took off after whatever these lights were.
Bandit? Back here.
Yeah, that's exactly what Partridge said. He said, Bandit, come back.
Bet he said it way cooler than I did.
Probably.
Probably all.
Bandit!
Bandit!
Come on back here, right. Boy!
That's plenty.
The poor dog paid no attention. Partridge himself got kind of freaked out, went back inside to get his gun, but was then even too scared to go back out once he had his gun. So he slept with his gun propped up next to his bed, and the next morning, when Bandit had not returned, he started getting increasingly worried. And 2 days later, he read in the newspaper about the sightings in Point Pleasant. Turns out, Bandit was gone.
Oh, man.
One statement in the newspaper talked about a member of the group that saw the creature at the TNT plant. And he said that as they were getting close to the city limits of Point Pleasant, they saw the body of a large dog lying on the side of the road.
Oh, man.
Then a few minutes later, on the way back out of town, the dog was gone. They even stopped to look for the body because they knew they had passed it just a few minutes before. Obviously, Mr. Partridge thought of his dog, Bandit, and poor Bandit really was never seen or heard of again. Makes me really sad when dogs...
Yeah, but he fed him off, man. It's the circle of life.
I don't know that that is part of the circle of life.
It's beautiful in its own way.
I'm pretty sure. This was gathering enough steam locally that on November 16th, a press conference was held.
Which is how many days since the initial spotting?
Only the day after.
Really?
But people are freaking out. So, well, the initial spotting was on the 12th, but the four couples saw it on the 15th. And on the 16th, a press conference was held. The couples were asked to repeat their story. Deputy Halstead, who'd known the couples all of his life, took them very seriously and communicated to the community and to the department that they'd never made any trouble. He had no reason to doubt their stories. Many of the reporters who were present at the press conference felt the exact same way. Basically, they said, these people are definitely telling the truth. The press dubbed the odd creature a Mothman at this point, so that's when it finally got its name. And it was actually named after a character from the popular Batman television series. I don't
really
know if you guys knew that.
Like the live action Adam West.
You bet.
Interesting.
Yep.
Adam West and Burt Ward.
And I don't know who played Mothman, but we should probably look that up. The TNT plant kind of became the rumored home of the Mothman. It was made up of several hundred acres of woods and a bunch of large concrete domes just under the ground and contained high explosives.
Wait, they still?
Yeah, just like little mini bunkers all over the place.
Doesn't seem safe.
No, it doesn't, but they really are all over the place.
What if this was just an urban legend to keep the kids away from the bunkers?
I don't think so, because there was a network of tunnels dug in the area, made it possible for this little Mothman guy to move about without ever being seen. Beyond that kind of labyrinthian structure, there was also a full wildlife station, which had artificial ponds and steep ridges and hills, gave lots and lots of hiding places for the Mothman, essentially. Could have hid weeks for there and remained totally unseen, according to investigators. The only people who wandered there were hunters and fishermen, and once in a while, local teenagers causing trouble. And there's also a great spot to park right by this area.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Oh, teenagers.
Yeah. Oh, to be young again.
This, I think, is one of the creepiest accounts of all of the things that happened with the Mothman. On the night of November 16th, the Ralph Thomas family says that they saw a funny red light in the sky that moved and hovered above the TNT plant. They say it wasn't an airplane, but a friend of the family said they couldn't figure out what it was. This friend of the family was Mrs. Bennett, and she drove to the Thomas house a few minutes later and got out of the car with her baby. As soon as she got out of the car, a figure stirred near the automobile. It seemed as though it had been laying down. And she later said it rose up slowly from the ground, a big gray thing, bigger than a man, with terrible glowing eyes. She was so terrified that she dropped her little girl.
Oh, okay. It seems like she dropped her girl and then came up with the story.
Then she quickly recovered, picked up her child, ran into the house. The family locked everyone inside, but hysteria gripped them as the creature shuffled onto the porch and peered into the windows.
I swear.
The police were summoned, but the Mothman had vanished by the time the authorities arrived. Mrs. Bennett didn't recover from the incident for months. And she was actually so upset about it that she went to get medical attention to deal with her anxieties.
Hmm.
She was tormented by frightening dreams, later told investigators that she believed the creature had visited her own home as well. She said that she could often hear a keening sound, like a woman screaming, near her isolated home on the edge of Point Pleasant.
That's kind of interesting, because have you ever heard of people report they hear screaming, but then they realize that it's themselves?
Oh, no, but that's scary. I don't like that.
Oh, it is scary. It's just because something so horrific happened, like maybe dropping a baby on accident, that you separate from yourself.
Here's what's really interesting, you guys. At this same time, there were UFO witnessings. Suddenly, men in black started popping up in the area. Many people believe that these were all linked somehow. For basically a full year, these strange happenings, both the sightings of the Mothman and then incidents with UFOs and men in black, completely spread like wildfire through this area. Researchers, investigators, and monster hunters descended on the area. And there was a famous author named John Keel who has since written quite a bit about Mothman and other unexplained circumstances in our country. He's written for many years about UFOs, but dismisses the standard extraterrestrial theories of the mainstream UFO movement, which, sidebar, sounds quite a bit like the disinformation thing that I've been discussing in recent weeks.
Sure.
Yeah. So this John Keel character became one of the people that primarily recorded everything that happened in Mothman. He's one of the reasons that we have such a detailed account of the circumstances that transpired over this full year. He wrote down that at least 100 people personally witnessed the creature between November 1966 and November 1967. According to those reports, he stood somewhere between 5 and 7 feet tall. He was wider than a man and shuffled on human-like legs.
So two, he's
right.
Was it
bipedal? They might bend a little weird. I don't really know.
Like backwards, like a deer?
Or like the thing centaur? In Men in Black? Yeah, maybe. I don't know. So it says that its eyes were near set at the top of its shoulders, and it had bat-like wings that glided rather than flapped when it flew. Strangely, though, it was able to ascend straight up like a helicopter. Witnesses also described its murky skin as being either gray or brown, and it emitted a humming sound when it flew. So it sounds like it's almost mechanical itself. It's very strange.
Huh. You know what would be a funny prank?
What?
So if you made like a Mothman kite and hooked it to someone's car.
Ooh, that would freak me out.
So then they keep trying to get away.
Oh, that'd be terrifying.
I am so
That's a horrible idea. Oh my God. I should do that to my dad.
Shop.frightday.com. Yeah. Get your Mothman kites.
So the Mothman was apparently unable to speak and rather just gave off a screeching sound again, which I tried to represent
don't.
At the beginning of the episode, but I'll was completely it. Blocked. Mrs. Bennett said that it sounded like a woman screaming specifically, but that was the only report we had that backed that up. Keel's in Point Pleasant starting in December of 1966, so about a month after all of this starts. He collects reports of Mothman sightings and even starts looking into UFO reports that have ramped up with the Mothman sightings, but some of which were taking place before he came onto the scene. He also realizes that right about the same time the Mothman appeared, people started reporting kind of these strange yet consistent stories of problems with their televisions and phones. These lights that have been seen in the sky, particularly around the TNT plant, definitely coincide with the Mothman's arrival. Cars in that area would sometimes just stall out without any given reason. He and researchers started uncovering even some poltergeist cases in that same area.
We're talking John Keel, right?
Yep. We are.
And he, for people who don't know, he wrote the Mothman Prophecies book.
He did.
Right. Okay.
He spoke with the James Lilly family, and they lived just south of the TNT plant. They were so freaked out by all of these events that they finally sold their home and moved to another neighborhood so they weren't so close to the plant, like literally because of the Mothman. All this activity was pretty intense for the community, and Keel believed that it was all connected. There weren't isolated things going on, that it was all part of the same issue, whatever that issue was.
You know what I think it was?
Sure. What?
Real quick, I don't mean to cut you off.
No, you're fine.
Pretty sure it's a Scooby-Doo situation.
Oh God, I do love Scooby-Doo.
You know, a man dressed up like a Mothman trying to keep kids away from the TNT plant?
I mean, it does sound like Scooby-Doo.
You
it
see
does.
What I'm saying?
Yeah, he wanted all the explosives for himself.
But I'll tell you what, Byron, here's the thing. What happened after this explains why it wasn't a Scooby-Doo situation. So unfortunately, this is a pretty long story.
Oh, no.
Well, we've got two different things. So
You're not going to do it, are you?
I am. I'm sorry. We have the rest of the story to talk about with what happened during the rest of the year that the Mothman was witnessed in Point Pleasant. And then we also have a comparison that I want to draw back to. There have been some interesting parallels between research done on a much older cryptid known as the Thunderbird, and specifically a Thunderbird artifact from Native American culture, and how that may or may not connect directly to the Mothman. So we're going to talk about that and the tragedy that befell the community where the Mothman arrived.
We've got a KCC two-parter on
our
hands, folks.
I'm sorry. It's just we've got such a great episode already with that interview you did. We've got so much wonderful content for this episode. I can't possibly try to squeeze the rest of the Mothman story in right now, but I promise you the second part is going to blow you away.
This is where the death toll rises.
Yes.
Thank you so much for that report, Kelly.
You're so welcome, guys. Thanks for listening.
Let's follow up that awesome interview with the charming Lauren Ashley Carter with a review of her new movie, Darling.
Let's do it.
Okay, Darling.
Darling. enjoying your visit here this evening. Now, on with the show.
Darling is a 2015 American psychological horror film written and directed by one of my favorites, Mickey Keating. It stars Lauren Ashley Carter. Sam, could you tell us what this movie's about?
Certainly. Darling follows a lonely young woman who moves into an old mysterious Manhattan mansion. Hired as a caretaker, it's not long before she discovers the estate's haunted reputation and troubling past, stories that slowly transform into a backdrop for her twisted and violent descent into madness.
Guys, I don't think I'll ever be able to stop thinking about Darling. I really had a good time in this movie.
Have you ever seen Eraserhead, Byron?
I have not.
Yeah.
Don't tell anyone that, though.
Okay. I promise not to tell anyone, Byron, that you haven't seen Eraserhead.
Okay.
Anyhow, there were some elements of it that I thought were present in it.
Other than the fact that it's black and white, what did you notice?
Very, very surreal and very... It also felt a little bit like Rosemary's Baby. I don't know if you got that feeling out
Absolutely.
Of it, too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such a beautiful film.
So beautiful.
And I don't necessarily fall into the black and white category.
I was just going to say, for you to feel the way you do about this movie, it says something about it.
Well, I have recently been diving into Alfred Hitchcock films. I'm finally dipping my toes in the classics, and I think that this is a beautiful representation of what you can learn from those films and then apply to a modern...
Absolutely. I mean, everyone has been drawing the Lynch comparisons here, but for me, this is very Hitchcockian.
Yeah.
The slow burn suspense and the descent into madness, I don't know how to better put it than that, is done so well.
Lauren Ashley Carter...
is bonkers in this movie.
She's the master of perturb. What I like about this movie is that it really allows her the screen time to expand her range. In Pod, she shines when shit's going out of control. But she's really amazing when you get some time to breathe with her. And I mean, she's on screen pretty much every scene.
I didn't feel like we had any time to breathe. I felt like the screws were just turned a little tighter with every new scene. But you mentioned some of the nuances in her performance. One of my favorite acting component is when Darling is in the bar and she's waiting for a gentleman who, played by Brian Morvent, who does a fantastic job, also another staple in Mickey Keating movies.
Pod.
Yeah.
Plays a completely different character in this film.
He does. But she's just absolutely racked by anxiety, terror, paranoia, and she telegraphs it in a way that the heroines or villainesses in Alfred Hitchcock's movies would have done. I mean, just the way she's fidgeting with her hands, really emoting in an incredible way that was very affecting and just made me feel antsy watching her.
Unsettling through and through, for sure.
How about the division into acts?
The chapters.
Yeah, the chapters.
I thought it was great, man. The way they even titled this movie, once again, nods at the classics and then twists it. The chapters are peppered with very aggressive sound design.
Yeah.
Which is super fun.
Aggressive, I like that.
And the fact that they're bright pink as opposed to black and white. This is the only glimpse of color that we get in this movie are these bright pink titles.
The titles reminded me a little bit of Crispin Glover's weird movies.
Yeah, what are those called, Kelly?
It's the It Trilogy.
The It Trilogy, which I've heard a lot about, and
I don't
know.
Have you not seen any of them?
I haven't, unfortunately.
We need to go. The next time he's anywhere close, we need to go.
I'd like to. I heard a really good interview with him on, I think it was probably Marc Maron or, or Nerdist. One of the.
You need to share that with me because I would love to hear.
He is an odd duck.
I love him. He's so wonderfully crazy.
But what were you comparing? The titles or the...
Yeah, just some of the way that they were, I don't know, they kind of tracked the descent into madness without being too on the nose. They were still obscure enough that they required some thought, and frankly, you weren't given enough time to fully absorb what was on those chapter cards as they flashed up there, which added to the sense of just kind of being left floundering for some sense of reality in this movie.
Well, let's go way back to the very beginning of this film. It opens up with a warning, which I very much appreciate.
I appreciate, yes.
It says, this film contains flashing lights and hallucinatory images, which is something.
Boy, does it.
Yeah, it very much does. First of all, Mickey does an amazing job.
Oh, hands down.
But it's almost a perfect storm of all the elements across the board. You have Lauren Ashley Carter, an amazing actress. You have Valerie
Krulpfeffer.
Thank you.
Krulpfeffer?
Yeah, it's close. The editing. Which is insane. One of the standout things I loved about Pod was the way they flashed lights in different clips to add to intensity of moments, which are also amplified, not a pun, by the sound design and the score.
The editing is so important to this movie. The quick cuts, again, lend to that sense of complete unbalance and displacement that you...
It's disorienting.
It really is. And also, I swear there are images, hidden images in between in some of the cuts, like there some are. Really quick flashes.
You know what? I just found out for the first time today.
What's that?
There are subliminal images in The Exorcist.
Really?
Yeah. There's these quick shots of a white face with like ghoulish teeth and eyes.
Yeah.
I've seen that photo. Yeah.
And that's, I mean, it's quick, but it's not like this quick.
You can make out the face.
Sure.
And it's supposed to be the demon.
It is. Yep.
So Valerie, she has done every one of Mickey's projects, Ritual, Pod, Carnage Park, and the upcoming film Psychopaths, which I think we're going to get a lot more of this really crazy editing because it's supposed to be, what do they call it? Like a psychedelic trip with several different serial killers in one night.
On the same night. Yeah.
So I'm very much looking forward to that project.
Me too.
And the composer, I had his name written down. It's very Italian, so you might have to help me. Giona Ostinelli?
Giona Ostinelli. Yeah,
that's probably right.
Thanks. So, and that's the same composer who did Pod and Ritual as well. So we've got the same team coming together and really nailing things.
I honestly, one of my favorite things about Mickey Keating is that he keeps the same team together. He's found what works, apparently very loyal to his people and respects the contributions that they've all made to making his movies what they are. And I think that kind of loyalty just speaks volume about character and also about, you know, when you find something that works.
Keep it up.
Yeah.
The spiral definitely spirals into something more than just...
An
internal spiral. There's a major moment of complete shock in this film.
There is.
And I very much appreciate it.
It was pretty good.
Unflinching violence that doesn't just end. There's almost like an instant resolution in most cases. And this really shows that there's some cleanup to do without spoiling things too much. Kelly's so mad.
It's the promo image. So.
No, I'm not mad.
That scene, man.
Yes.
You're not expecting that.
No, I don't. I mean, we can't really talk about it much more than that because, I mean, you know it's coming, I think, but witness it for yourself.
I'm just saying they usually skip over that portion of these situations being very vague, and I apologize, but I appreciate that they didn't.
Yeah. I thought that it combined aspects of three things that I really like. The psychological element where, you know, you get to follow this cracking mind,
not breaking, Emily.
Exactly. And you know, you're never sure whether the perception is the reality or if she really is just a loon. So there's that aspect, the internal mental struggle, and then there's the very visceral physical violence of it. And then, not to give too much away, I almost feel it's this Lovecraftian eldritch horror lurking element as well.
Sure.
I wouldn't think you could put those three things together this effectively, but there it is.
So, Kelly, do you have any last words about Darling?
I just think that the movie is very much a testament to what a strong actress Lauren Ashley Carter is, because she clearly had to carry the whole thing. It was made or broken on her performance, and I think she was quite remarkable. And what I would imagine, I'm not an actress, but what I would imagine is a fairly difficult role. I thought it was really interesting. I obviously love Lynch, so the connections there were great. I love black and white. I liked the stylized element of the movie. I would give this one a 7.0.
I loved everything about this movie. I mean, I know this gets thrown around and I think it's a stupid phrase generally, but I really feel like this has elevated itself beyond simply horror and it's great cinema by any name. The photography, which we mentioned briefly, the views, just the bleak, lonely, empty, sweeping panoramas of New York are just so effective in isolating you and, again, kind of not giving you any frame of reference in terms of time or place. The editing that just leaves you reeling and the application of violence. Again, with, like Kelly mentioned, Lauren Ashley Carter's performance as Darling, Brian Morvan's supporting performance.
And the fess. Bonus Fest. We got a quick Larry Fessenden.
Yeah.
Can't leave that out.
In a role not typical for him.
Absolutely.
I adored this movie. I can't wait to see what Mickey Keating has in store for us with Psychopaths.
And Carnage
and
Park.
Carnage Park. I'm going to give this movie an 8.5.
I started this review by saying that I don't think I'll ever stop talking about Darling. And I mean that. I love this movie.
I'm sensing some top 10 of the year
presents. Well, let's pump the brakes, but don't pump them too hard.
I won't.
Every element of this movie combined in a perfect storm of something that was fresh and classic. The editing is amazing. The stutter effect, it wrecks me. It turns me inside out. And that would be nothing without Ostinelli on the sound. In Lauren Ashley Carter. I've been following her for years. She gets nothing but better and better with everything I see her. Plus, she reads Jackie Chan audiobooks.
That's pretty fantastic.
Pretty fantastic. I give this a 9.2. I love this movie.
Whoa!
And I can't wait for you guys to see it when it comes out.
April 1st in theaters and April 8th VOD.
Thanks, Sam. Go see it in the theaters. The sound design's incredible. And to see it on a big screen, I don't know if I could handle it. It would be too much for me. I'd be curled up in a ball of gut mess.
Or evidently, if you have some kick-ass home speakers, that's okay too.
Absolutely. And that's our review of Darling. I can't wait for you guys to tell us what you think about that. But in the meantime, why don't you just tell us what you thought about this episode at Fright Day on Twitter, or leave a comment in the show notes of this episode at FrightDay.com.
Yes.
And if you like our show and want to help us make it even better, you can pick up something at shop.frightday.com. I think there's going to be some new variants of stuff coming up pretty soon.
Woohoo!
So keep your eyes there. Or you could just pledge some money at patreon.com/frightday, which would give you access to some pretty cool stuff, like the upcoming episode of Captain Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracies.
God, as well, so great.
As well as a weekly hangout with us before the shows, where we can talk about all kinds of fun stuff.
Don't forget Sam's Jam.
Like serial killers. And you get access to Sam's Jams, which is a playlist of all of the best things in Sam's mind.
We've had some feedback that those playlists have some pretty miraculous results for listeners.
You can get jacked to it, or you can just work in a wood shop to it, or you'd climb a mountain to it.
Work your customer service job.
That's also
whatever.
True. And most helpful of all, you can leave a review for us on iTunes. That's pretty much the best thing you could do for us.
Definitely. Please. Thank you.
Thank you, guys, for hanging out. Kelly, you look like you're falling apart.
I am. My throat hurts really bad.
Decaying.
So much talking tonight.
It's because you were making pterodactyl noises for the Mothman.
Yeah, please do not do that.
That's not why.
Oh, I wish I recorded them so I could play them for the...
Right. Byron, you know better.
Kelly, where can we find you on the internet? Oh, please. Sam, how about you?
On Twitter at Sam Frightday. Email me, sam@frightday.com. Instagram, sam_milodragovic.
Oh, no.
Whoa.
Okay.
You can take it out if you want to. I honestly don't care.
Really?
Going big.
Yeah, sure. What do you think? Do you think that's too much of a plug?
I don't give a fuck. Are you kidding me?
You don't give a fuck?
Not at all, dude.
That is new. I'm not giving out mine.
Well, you don't get to give anything. You lost your privileges, Mothman.
I'm jumping in.
All right.
2 feet.
And I'm at Byron McCoy on Twitter and Instagram. Byron@frightday.com is my email address, which reminds me, we also have an Instagram for Fright Day. It's just at Fright Day.
Check it out.
Insta.
And until next Fright Day, I'm Byron.
I'm Mothman.
And I'm Sam.
Stay sane.